How do you build a high-performing culture? This is Culture Architects, candid conversations with extraordinary leaders sharing their biggest successes, failures, and lessons learned on their culture journeys. Here's David J. Friedman.
My guest this week is Peter Bayer. Peter is the Senior Vice President of Operations at Penske Logistics. Most notably, Peter is also the recipient of the Silver Star when he was serving in the U.S. Army during Operation Iraqi Freedom. He was a two-star general, and he helped develop the strategy that brought down the regime in Baghdad. Peter joined Penske after his career in the Army in 2014, and he leads a lot of different warehousing and transportation operations across the U.S. So, Peter, welcome to our podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Really happy to be with you, David.
So I want to just, for our audience, get a little bit of background here. So I know, again, you served 30 years in the U.S. Army. Give me a little background as to, did you always know you were going to go in the Army? Was that something that, what caused you to say, you know what, I think I want to be in the military?
I did not go to college thinking that I was going to join the Army. Okay. I went to Lehigh University. And I come from a big Lehigh family. My grandfather, my dad, and six of his brothers went there and a couple cousins. And my cousin Chip was a year ahead of me at Lehigh in Army ROTC on a four-year scholarship. Mm-hmm. We're pretty close, and he talked me into joining. Uh-huh. And my freshman year, I was the guy that, you know, had my hair at the maximum length, was really enjoying my college experience, was moderately excited about it. And this, of course, was the Reagan buildup, you know, defense buildup years. Uh-huh. And they convinced me at the end of my freshman year to apply for a three-year scholarship, which I won. And even when I earned my commission in 1984, I thought I'd do 4 years in the Army and then get out and be rich and famous. And four turned into eight, turned into 15, et cetera. And I spent just under 30 years. It was a great adventure.
That's great. Fantastic. And we appreciate your service. So the military, we're obviously going to be talking about culture, and when I think about organizations that are purposeful or intentional about their culture and do it extraordinarily well, it's hard to think of anybody that does this better than the military. So why do you think, let me first ask, why do you think the military emphasizes a particular culture so strongly?
Well, it's really, I mean, the military is all about team and a sense of common purpose. And the reality for those in uniform is, You are ultimately asked to do what I consider to be the, you know, the most difficult and demanding team sport on earth, which is go to combat. So the culture that is really values-based is built around norming people to an understanding that there's something bigger than themselves, built on a set of common values, and it's, in addition, a set of common standards. I mean, there's a right way and a wrong way to do something. And in the military, it's very black or white. There's no gray areas in terms of the standards. But it's a requirement. If you're gonna form a team, you've got to have that common backdrop, right? That common sense purpose, which, and as you know, culture, you know, I often tell folks, you know, culture is really the sum of our behaviors rather than a bumper sticker, which some people make culture into, right? They'll say their culture is something, but their behaviors are different. In the military, we're very oriented on those behaviors, right? Because the ultimate test of those behaviors is in combat.
Yeah. So do you think in your experience and observation, you know, all of the branches of the military are certainly, I would think, from an outsider's perspective, they're equally passionate about the importance of culture and equally committed to building their cultures. What's different, if anything, about the Army culture, let's say, than Navy, Marines, or others, or Air Force?
Well, if you could see me now, I'm smiling because those of us that...
Yours is better, of course. The Army's better, yeah. I'm assuming.
Well, as I often tell, I've got a lot of good friends in all the services, but I often tell, especially my Marine friends, that, you know, being a Marine is a great second choice if you weren't good enough to get in the Army. I mean, all of us are uniquely different with respect to your mission set and to some regard the type of people that are attracted there. You know, the Air Force, for instance, a little more technical in terms of the skills. And they attract a different person than the Marine Corps or the Army does. Mm-hmm. I think the commonality is it goes back to this sense of purpose and this idea of you're serving something bigger than yourself.
Right.
And every one of the services has a unique set of values that are fundamental to who you are and serve as that foundational or that bedrock element that enable you to perform uniformly as a team.
Yeah.
And all of the services, you know, specialize in breaking down the individual and kind of reforming you when you begin training so that you're focused on things that are bigger than yourself. You know, I would, while in uniform, and I still engage, do a lot of nonprofit back into the military sector. But I used to always tell young soldiers that, you know, if you think about the oath that everyone in uniform takes to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, you don't take an oath to the President of the United States by name. Mm-hmm. Now, you take an oath to this body of ideas that really out of that document comes those ideas that quite honestly serve as the basis for our values.
Mm-hmm.
That's a common theme, a common backdrop for everyone in uniform, regardless of your branch of service.
Got it. Let's talk about the Army specifically. Obviously, that's your experience. Mm-hmm. What are the key core values that the Army professes? That's and I say profess in a positive way, not in a derogatory way, that the Army promotes, I'll use that word, that when you say this is what we stand for, what are those values?
It's seven values, okay. And you're going to challenge me now to remember them. I remember them by the acronym leadership. The first one is loyalty, right? So I'll be loyal to bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution. I'll be loyal to my superiors, my peers, my subordinates, my organization. The second one is duty, and it's this idea of fulfill your obligations. Mm-hmm. And in the Army, we have something we call the warrior ethos, which really exemplifies, you know, the essence of what service in uniform on your team is. And inside of this idea of duty, the warrior ethos is four very simple things. The mission is always first. I will never accept defeat, I'll never quit, and I'll never leave a fallen comrade. Mm. And having been to combat multiple times, I will tell you that that really exemplifies the bedrock essence of our culture, our values, etc. And I often would tell folks, soldiers, that, you know, if you want to understand that warrior ethos and this idea of duty and our Army values, pick up any Medal of Honor citation and just read it. And the citation never says that this soldier, non-commissioned officer, or officer was the number one graduate in their class or the best at tactics, etc. What it said is that soldier did not give up. They did whatever was required to get the mission done, to take care of their buddies, often at the cost of their life, right? So embedded in this idea of duty is this really deep ethos of serving. I'm going to get it done. I serve my team and I'm never going to quit, period. Mm-hmm. Our third value is respect. And this is, you know, very fundamental of treat people as they ought to be treated, plain and simple. It's as many of us were taught by our families, you know, the golden rule. Our next value is selfless service, where you put the welfare of the nation, the Army, and your subordinates above your own. So it's this idea of you're serving something bigger than yourself. Mm-hmm. Our next is honor. You know, by honor, what the Army says is live up to our honor, our Army values, and, you know, don't ever do anything that would cause anyone to disrespect you or the institution because of your conduct.
Right? Got it.
Our next value is integrity. Very simply, do what's right, legally and morally. And we talk a lot in the Army about discipline. This idea of discipline is doing it to standard when nobody's looking. Well, that's built on this basis of integrity. Nice. And then our last value is personal courage, which is the ability to face fear, danger, or adversity and do your job. as you can well imagine, for someone in uniform, particularly when you go to combat, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. So you did well there, Pete. You know them.
Well, they are ingrained, trust
me. Good. So let's talk about that, because one of the things that, you know, we teach all the time is we are very behaviors-based. These are the things that we call them fundamentals that people practice. But I also emphasize that there's so many things we need to do to ingrain them, to embed them. It's not enough, as you said, to have them on a bumper sticker or have them on a wall or on the website. These have to be ingrained. So talk to me about what are some of the things that you do in the Army to ingrain those seven values? How did these get absorbed into people?
Well, the first is you hear them all the time from your leadership from the moment you join. The moment you put on a uniform, it's a constant theme. You know, one of the things I learned as a leader is if it's important, say it again, and then do it. Right? Mm-hmm. So it needs to be just part of your language. From the moment, you know, for me as a young officer, when I, you know, in Army ROTC and then the training that I went through, it was constantly reinforced by everyone around me. And then once you are serving in a leadership position, the expectation is that it's fundamental to not only how you act, but how you communicate. So words like loyalty and duty and respect and selfless service, you know, they're common terms that are integrated all the time, and it becomes the expectation. And then we hold ourselves accountable for it. So, you know, as a commissioned officer, you have, when you're in a command billet, right, you have command authority, you have significant authority under the Uniform Code of Military Justice to enforce discipline and good order in a unit. And essentially, you have the authority to, you know, act as a judge and jury, essentially, to discipline soldiers with respect to taking away their liberty, reducing them in rank, taking pay from them, or causing them to perform extra duty, which means work after hours, and or some combination of all of those. And we're pretty harsh critics. My experience in uniform was we hold ourselves to a high standard, and we're harsh on ourselves when people violate those fundamental values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here's an interesting, as you're talking, what's going through my mind is I'm thinking about how closely the things you're describing map to the framework that we talk about. So we talk about in civilian world or culture in general, what I call the 8-step framework, 8 different things that I say and write about in my books, that if we do these 8 things, this is how we become really systematic about building a culture in any organization. So I want to take those 8 steps in that 8-step framework and relate them to what you're describing and ask you about them. So the first of the 8 steps that I talk about in the 8-step framework, you've already identified, and that is you can't build a specific culture if you don't define with enough clarity, well, what is the culture we're trying to create? And as you're describing, clearly the Army does that exceptionally well. The second thing that I talk a lot about, and I want to ask you about this, is I talk about the importance of what I call creating rituals. And I certainly know the Army is very ritualistic, and that the reason that, in my view, rituals are so important is that they become sustainable ways to teach the things that are important to us, so that they don't become the flavor of the month. When they become baked into how we operate, they just become second nature, and that's what we do. So talk about what are some of the rituals that the Army uses to help people internalize those values. I know they're all about rituals. Give me a couple examples of how does the Army use rituals to help soldiers internalize these values?
Well, I think the first and probably the most significant way is through training. Mm-hmm. You know, the Army, as do the other services, you are constantly practicing your craft. And when you're doing that, you know, we often say in the Army is, you never assign someone, there's no such thing as one person doing a task. You are always doing it. The smallest unit, so to speak, is a buddy team, two soldiers. So part of that, you know, so you're building into that accountability and this idea of selfless service, right? It's about something bigger than yourself. And if nothing else, it's about that man or woman that you're with at that time. But training, and we always say train as you fight. So those seven values are fundamental to our ability to go prosecute armed conflict, you know, on behalf of the nation when directed. And training is the repetitive process of practicing something. So when you are faced with a set of conditions, you have an intuitive response to it. And as an example, let me give you an example of this, how it creates this ritual of going back to this idea of duty, respect, honor, integrity, right? In combat, particularly the type of combat that we've seen post 9/11, where the battlefield is littered with people who you can't tell apart, right? Because the combatants we face aren't in uniforms. They're not in regular forces. And when you're on patrol in some town in, you know, some country amidst the population, you don't know who among them wants to kill you that day. So, and often you have less than 2 seconds to make a decision on, am I going to shoot this person or, you know, and the way you develop the ability to do that is through training, right? Repetitive training of shoot, no shoot based on something you see. And that's very ritualistic. But embedded in that idea, and I'll give you an example here of, you know, when I was in Iraq in a convoy getting hit with an IED and a small arms ambush, within 2 minutes, the soldiers in that convoy go from being attacked, returning fire, to rendering aid to those that they just engaged.
Wow.
The discipline, the ritualistic training enabled them to react with appropriate response. When it was time to cease fire, they immediately went back to this kind of value of respect, right? And rendered aid to those that had just engaged that 3 minutes ago were trying to kill them.
Wow.
That's an example of a really strong culture, right? That's built on this bedrock of strong values through training. So to me, probably the most significant is creating the ritual. It's training.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. And in a sense, we talk about the same thing in a corporate environment. When you practice and you talk about these things over and over and over and over and over again, they become reflexive. They become, boom, that's the way we do things around here. And without it doesn't. Fascinating. So first step for us is defining the culture. You've got your army values. Second is creating rituals. Third step we talk about in a corporate environment is selecting the right people to join the team. And you talked a bit about how, to some extent, I guess in the army, you can tell me, to some extent, you have the ability to select who gets in, or do you? I mean, when people, if I want to enlist in the army, can almost anybody enlist? I mean, outside of...
Well, yeah, I mean, we're all free to do it. But one of the interesting statistics is, and I think this is still current, amongst the U.S. population, males age 18 to 24, which is the prime recruiting cohort, 75% of them cannot enter any branch of the armed forces without at least one waiver for either physical, mental, or moral issues.
Wow.
So only 25% of our population actually meets the criteria. Women are a little better, meet the criteria to join the armed forces without a waiver. But theoretically, in an all-volunteer force, any of us can join, right? Here's what I would tell you, and I absolutely agree with you, it's about people. And I find that in my job, you know, my leadership position right now with Penske, selecting the right people. And, you know, one of the things in Penske, we're big on the, you know, the good to great, right? Get everybody in the right seat on the bus. In the military, you have who you have. So then it's about how do I develop them? And I'll be honest with you, in 38 years of leadership, virtually every team I've been on has had about the same distribution of talent, right? A bell curve. Where about you got about 30% at the top part, they're strong in their attributes of initiative, learners, dedicated, want to do better, seek advancement, et cetera. Somewhere between 5 and 10%, they're just in the wrong place. They don't have the right attributes, right? And they sign up for the wrong job. and they're gonna weed themselves out over time, and you spend an inordinate amount of time with them as a leader, but they're, and then you have this natural curve of, you know, a little below average to slightly below above average.
Right.
And really, as a leader, your job is to get those folks to give you 100% every day. Right.
Right.
So I agree with you, selecting the right people, but it's more of where do they fit on my team versus, because sometimes you just have what you have.
Right. In the Army, you certainly do. I mean, in civilian life, though, depending upon your role, you may have inherited people that they're already there. All right, Pete, let's stop there. But coming up in the second part of my conversation with Pete Bayer, the Senior Vice President of Operations at Penske Logistics, we're going to continue our rundown of the 8 simple steps to drive better individual and organizational performance. And Pete's going to talk a little bit more about being a servant leader with humility.
Being a servant leader means you truly are in service to others and being humble enough to learn from your subordinates. And that's a hard thing. And I have found most of what I've learned from subordinates. You know, I had no idea how to price a warehouse deal, but I learned that from people who are subordinate to me on my team.
This has been Culture Architects with David J. Friedman. Be sure to join us next time for more insights and wisdom from great leaders from all walks of life. To book David for your events or to learn more about his writing, speaking, or consulting, go to davidjfriedman.com. Culture Architects with David J. Friedman is a production of Forbes Books.